Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. And you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I remember I received one slip note that said, this is for black readers, and black readers don't really buy enough books for you to sustain a career. I remember that on one occasion.
Hi, welcome to Write Off, a podcast about writing rejection and how people get through it. I'm Francesca Steele, a journalist and writer in London. Writing rejection has been a subject close to my heart ever since I didn't manage to sell my own first novel last year. If you're interested, you can hear a little bit more about that in the first episode in this series or in the trailer. My guest this week is the British novelist Alex Wheatle. Alex has such an extraordinary story that when he was working in the writer's room for Steve McQueen's BAFTA-winning film series Small Axe, McQueen, the Oscar-winning director behind 12 Years a Slave, ended up making one of the films about Alex's own life. When Alex's parents were unable to cope with raising children for various reasons, Alex was sent to Shirley Oaks, a notorious Croydon children's home that just last year was the subject of an inquiry uncovering sustained physical, sexual and racist abuse. Alex experienced all of those things as a child. He emerged as a teenager in Brixton, undereducated and ill-prepared for adulthood, and in 1981 was sent to prison for a year for his involvement in the Brixton riots. Prison, though, turned out to be Alex's salvation. There, he met a man who encouraged him to revive his childhood love of reading, and from that came his writing. Several years later, Alex wrote Brixton Rock. As you'll hear, it took more than 30 rejections and an incredible amount of self-belief, but that book, about a Brixton care home kid, in some ways just like Alex, was published in 1999. Since then, Alex has published 16 more books, including his YA book, Croncton Nights, for which he won the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize in 2016. In 2008, he was awarded an MBE for services to literature. Alex's books are all clever, realistic portrayals of places that don't really get enough of a look in usually in English literature. Kids living in estates, gangland culture and so on. And yet they're not heavy, they're lively and funny and accessible. They're things that teenagers do actually want to read. Alex defines himself as a survivor, not a victim, and I found him an inspiring reminder of what can be achieved through perseverance. We talked a lot about the difficulties for black authors in publishing both 20 years ago and now, and also about the extraordinary advantage a love of reading can give kids in even the direst circumstances. So here's Alex. You're 20 years into a really successful writing career now, but you didn't have an easy childhood. You grew up in care after your mum and dad left, and you didn't have a good experience there. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about what that experience growing up was like, and also how it affected your education and your imagination.
It left me with very little confidence. I think that was the main thing, where I struggled to believe in myself that I could produce anything that was worthy. And so it left me with this feeling that I was unwanted, unworthy, not valued, and that I'd never amount to much in life. And so even though, when I look back, I was an avid reader from the age of 5 or 6, I was reading comics. And sometimes as a child, when you're enjoying something, you forget that it's a skill set, you know, this reading. that I had, you know, it seemed to come naturally to me that I could pick up something and start reading it. I'm not quite sure where that came from because my education was very scatty and disrupted, you know, through the ages up to 11 and onwards from 11 to 16. So, but I always had this reading ability. And I think in the end that saved me because when I ended up in prison and I had a dense text like the Black Jacobins, I could still understand it, process it, and I could comprehend it. And so I always had that to fall back on, even though in myself, I felt that I would amount to very little. And so I think that was the main thing that I had to conquer. I mean, obviously there's physical scars, there's mental scars, but it was the belief, I think, that perhaps I struggled with the most, that I could actually, you know, I'm actually good at something. It took me a long while to convince myself. And I think many writers go through that same issue. Am I worthy of this? Can I actually have a book out there that can be seen in the shelves of bookstores and airport shops and so forth? But, so we have to have that inner belief, that inner confidence that, hey, my story is good enough. Hey, my story is worthy, is readable. And if I love it, then why shouldn't others love it? Mm. And so when I started to think about writing a novel, because I had tried my, I tried to write lyrics for songs, I tried to write bits of poetry and so on. When it came to writing a novel, I had to convince myself that the characters that I'm writing about, the situation that I'm writing about is just as important as any other. And I think that's why it took me so long to actually sit down in my late 20s, I think it was, to pen Bricks and Rock. Otherwise, if I had that belief, I probably would have done it a lot earlier.
When you were in the care home, were you going to a school in that sort of complex?
Up to a secondary age, I was going to a primary school within the complex. Basically, I hardly received any proper education there. It was basically babysitting kind of exercise. Okay. Where, funny enough, most of the concentration was on gymnastics for some reason, because the head teacher, he had that was his thing. You know, he loved gymnastics, and I think he was involved at some kind of high level in his young days. So, you know, we had about two or three gymnastics lessons a day. Or it wasn't that; it was band music. Like you could have an option of learning to blow the French horn or trombone, because Sherlock Children's Home, it had this history of doing parades in Central Croydon over the years. You know, I'm going back to the late 19th century, where they used to parades, and they kept that tradition. And so it was required of anybody in Churchyard Children's Home to learn a musical instrument. I never did. I could never get the hang of it. So,
but you had an imagination. You had an imagination. And you were reading these comic books, and you were and you were thinking of that sort of stuff from early on. Was that an escape from the life that you were living? Because
I was physically abused, sexually abused at times as well. So to be given a space to read a comic or any other book that I could find, Huckleberry Finn was one that I found discarded on the dormitory floor. It certainly offered me a means of escape. So, you know, in those hours between my bedtime, 8 o'clock, and until I fell asleep, I could just wander to a space where I felt safe. And that's what comics and magazines did for me. So I cherished that. And this is why I believe reading is so important, especially at a young age, because we don't know what goes on behind closed doors. It doesn't have to be a children's home where a young person can be treated unfairly or be abused. And so reading can offer that escape. It can offer some kind of solace, as it did for me. Mm. And I think if it wasn't for that, I really don't think I would be a writer today.
Yes, I can see that. Alex, thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, what an awful experience. How incredible it is that you got through it and are here today talking about all the books you've written and able to look back on your past so wisely. And then after you left the home, you moved to Brixton and you had this experience that is in part fictionalized in Brixton Rock. And and also the tale of which is told in Small Axe, where you were part of the Brixton riots and spent a brief stint in prison. I wonder if you can tell me about that and the man you met who sort of changed everything for you by encouraging you to read.
Well, moving to Brixton was, in a way, a culture shock for me, even though I'm obviously Black. I'm from the Jamaican background. My parents were born in Jamaica. But being a kid raised in Shirley Oaks, where it's kind of the surroundings of Shirley Oaks is very, very rural kind of Surrey kind of belt, Sopwith belt, if you like. So I kind of grew up with all those sensibilities around me. So coming to Brixton was like, what's happening here kind of thing. So that was difficult for me. But slowly and surely, I managed to feel like a sense of belonging for the first time in my life. And reggae music helped with that sense of identity that I so sorely lacked. And so Brixton was Brixton back in the late 70s, 1980s. It erupted in what we like to call the uprising in 1981. I played a part in that, and so I was sentenced to a year's prison, Wormscrubs. And there, very fortunate for me that my cellmate was Simeon, who was an avid reader. And on his shelf, he had books by Richard Wright. He had books by Chester Hines. So many. John Steinbeck was a big favorite of his. So I remember reading East of Eden. So many. I even read Dickens, Bleak House. I remember reading that. But again, because I had that grounding, if you like, in reading from a very early age, no book was a big test to me. I could gobble it up, understand it, comprehend it. And so really, that was my education. Who knows whether I would have been a writer, but being with Simeon definitely helped. It kind of reminded me of my love of reading.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask, you know, it seems so random, so fortunate that you ended up with him as a cellmate. And obviously he turned you on to a lot of books that you felt very passionate about. Do you think you would have had a different path had you not met him?
Hopefully, Francesca, I would have found my tribe, found my passion, found my writing and reading ability, or reconnected with that passion that I had as a young kid. It might have taken me longer, but hopefully I would have found it somehow, by hook or by crook. But at least that that meeting with Simeon, that connection with him, it led me to be creative. That's the important thing here. So as soon as I emerged from prison, I started to write bits of poetry and lyrics and songs. So that creative energy in me was let loose. And that changed my life, because before I thought, the words in my head, people would laugh at if I put them on a page, or if I performed it in any way, in any kind of space. I didn't have the confidence to do that. But because I had that experience with Simeon, who informed me that my story was important, my craft is important, my words are important, my life was important, that gave me the strength to perform my words. There used to be this poetry night in Brixton underneath the arches. And I would go to that and perform my poetry and my songs, and people would clap. And I thought, wow, oh my gosh, you know, people actually like what I produced creatively. You know, that was an amazing boost to me. It really was. And so from that, I just, you know, in the end, I eventually drew up the courage to write a full length novel.
So how did that come about? Because that was, I mean, Brixton Rock was published in 1999, and obviously your stint in prison was 81 82. When did you start writing the novel, and how did that go? And you mentioned before that, you know, that you'd not had much self-confidence. I mean, self-doubt is such a huge part of any debut novelist experience, I think. How did that go for you, and how long did it take you?
Around about 92, 93. I mean, Francesca, I don't know about yourself, but I used to write on anything. Backs of record albums, bits of notepads here and there, scraps of paper. These were the origins of Brixton Rock. And also based on a small part of my experiences or friends' experiences, especially my mixed race friends who had to, who endured their time in Shirley Oaks. And so I just cobbled all these strands together and came up with the Brixton Rock narrative. And I started to write the novel around about 93, 94 in longhand, which did no favours to my fingers. So yeah, it was just a collection really of scribblings and rantings and ideas and life experiences that I had that I managed to try to pull together. I just didn't know. I wasn't aware that you had to present your manuscript typed, obviously, double spaced and all that. I didn't know that. So I just went off to the my reference library, and they had the writer's yearbook there. I'm sure all writers know about that, or aspiring writers know about that. And so me, I thought I was going to make $1 million. And so I went for the most grand title possible, I think, within that writer's yearbook. And so there I went. I slipped my my carefully written manuscript into the bubble envelope, and I kind of waited with crossed fingers, and I didn't get no reply.
Oh, God.
I thought, what's going on here? What's going on? So I actually went to the literature agents concerned, and I asked the receptionist, has my manuscript been received? And she asked me for my name. I said, Alex Sweetall, I'm going to be a massive star one day. And we had a little giggle. We had a little giggle about that. And she dropped it to me very slowly and politely that, Mr. Weetle, next time perhaps you should think about typing up your manuscript rather than writing it in longhand. I was so crushed.
Oh,
I was
God.
So crushed. And I didn't look at my manuscript for about a year or so. And then I bumped into one of my old friends, my old hustler friends. He's a bit like a South London del boy. And he had all things and sundry for sale. And one of those items was a very old typewriter. And so I bought it off him for £10. So on that typewriter, I typed up my first draft of Brits and Rock. Even then, it was rejected. I remember Stephen King came to the South Bank, I cannot remember what year, and he was talking about Carrie, his first novel, and he said that he received over 50. So I thought, okay, if Stephen King can cope with over 50 rejections, then surely I can. And by this time, I had about approaching 30, I think 28 or 29 rejections. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to carry on, I'm going to continue with this, my dream. Into a novel.
Did it feel cathartic?
Or absolutely, it did.
Did it feel nerve-wracking as well?
Both those things, I think. I think writing for me, in a way, when I first started writing Bricks and Rock, it wasn't, I didn't have the goal of being published in mind. For me, it was about my own mental health. And this is the way I dealt with it and coped with it. You know, everybody has to deal with a coping mechanism. And writing was mine. It was my self-expression, what I needed, because two occasions where I was offered counselling, I rejected it because I just felt it very strange. I'm sitting down with somebody who I don't know, and they're asking all these very personal questions, and I wasn't quite the right person for that. So for me, the best way that I could express what's going on inside my head and my heart was through the written page. And so it definitely helped me deal with the trauma that I had, because sometimes you're going through trauma, but you grow up and you don't even recognize that it was trauma. You cannot even identify it as, you know, that it destabilized me. And because of that trauma, I made very sometimes dodgy decisions. And so it's through the writing process that I finally managed to look back without flinching. And started to deal and process what had happened to me as a child.
And so it's, you spent a few years writing the book in longhand. I know you mentioned you had about 30 rejections.
Yeah.
How long did those take in total? And what sorts of things did they say as well, if you can remember?
The general gist was that it wasn't for a reading audience. It was very niche, and I remember I received one slip note that said, this is for black readers, and black readers don't really buy enough books for you to sustain a career. I remember that on one occasion.
Wow.
And so a few said they loved the idea, the story, but I needed to work on my English grammar. I remember that.
Oh, okay.
And I did work on my English grammar because it wasn't the best, I have to admit. there's only three or four, I think, agents that actually like the story. But 20-odd said that this wasn't for us. I cannot see this being published or this kind of story being published. But I just believed, and I hope aspiring writers have that same belief, that every story is worth something. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely believe that, and that's why I carried on.
So what happened? You kept on sending off to agents and eventually one said yes?
Yes, I did. In fact, I was very close to being published with headline. I remember that particular letter was very encouraging.
So were you sending to publishers at the same time as agents?
Yes,
I think
I was. Yeah.
At that time, publishing houses accepted more direct submissions, I think.
Some did, some didn't. Yeah. And headline did. I didn't have an agent at the time. But I remember I was going to this writers group and one of the members there said they knew an editor at headline. And so I sent a manuscript to her. She couldn't get it acquisition, but she sent me a really encouraging letter, said to keep on going and so on. I smelt victory. I really smelt victory. So that gave me an extra spurt. And I think within a few months, I was acquired by a very small publisher, Black Hammer Books, run by Rosemary Hudson, who was Jamaican born. And she lived over here and publishing was her dream. And Bricks and Rock was her second title. So that was my beginning. And wow, you know, it was an incredible moment.
So 30-something rejections in, you get accepted by this smaller publisher. And would you remember what you did when you received that phone call or letter or whatever saying it was going ahead?
I was very sceptical. I thought someone was having me on. When, Rosemary said to me, we want to publish your book. I thought, who is this? You know, you're having me on, but she said, no, I'm Rosemary Hudson. You sent me your manuscript. I love it. So, wow. You know, I had a bit of a celebration with the family when I received that news. It was such a fantastic moment. I mean, for someone like me, who didn't go on to further education, was expelled on a few occasions, you know, I had no proper examinations that I sat for. For me to get published was just an amazing achievement, I felt. You know, it's my... probably my single number one achievement of my career. You know, just to get that first book published was incredible.
Looking back, it sounds like you had so much innate resilience and persevered. But do you remember how it felt when you were in the process of getting those rejections? And because also your story is very personal. And in a way, although it is fiction, you know, Brendan is a sort of fictionalized version in some ways of you and the people you knew, I guess. And also the rejections in some way, you know, quite personal as well. There aren't enough Black readers to sustain your career and that how did that all of that feel to you over that time period, which was presumably a couple of years? Or
it felt like, I guess some people might say this might sound cocky or arrogant, but I kind of believed, what are you talking about? You know, I mean, I remember my partner at the time would say, I would say to my partner, I'm going to call him up. I'm going to have a debate about this. I'm going to call him up and argue my case. And she would say, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. But if I did call him up, I would have said, why? Why are you rejecting my work? This is fantastic. This is worth its place on the bookstores in any town. You know, I would have argued my case. So I always had this belief that the story was worthy and valuable. I always had that, even though, yes, of course you're disappointed. I mean, when you open that envelope, because of those days, I'm not sure how it goes today. I guess it's email or whatever, but you know, this is the mid 1990s. When you receive that envelope and it's from a publishing house and you see the stamp and everything, you kind of have a genuine sense of adrenaline and you think, wow, this could be the moment. But for them to say, no, it's not quite for you. Of course your heart sinks. Of course it does. And if you had a cat, you might want to kick it. And you know, with me, I used to go to Clapham Common and sulk under the bandstand of, oh no, you know, would this ever happen for me? But 2-3 days later, I'd be up again. I'm thinking, okay, who can I send it to now? Someone out there is going to like this. And I genuinely believe that.
That's amazing. What do you think would have happened if it hadn't sold? Would you have written something else and just moved on to another story?
I think so. I really think so. Because as I said, writing was my therapy. And I would have definitely continued to write, even though I was receiving rejections. I mean, I was writing bits anyway, even though I was submitting Bricks and Rock to publishers and literary agents. So that would have continued. And I always had the opportunity to express or perform my works in poetry jams and so forth. So I'm sure I would have been creative. It would have formed part of my life, you know, up to I'm 58 now, and I'm sure I would have been still doing that.
There's something really interesting you say at the end of Brixton Rock, mm-hmm. where you say that the inventiveness of your friend's language was amazing to you because as you've mentioned here, actually, you'd grown up in Croydon and outside of that space, and then you moved to Brixton, and this patois and this dialogue that you is so vibrant in the book was new and vibrant to you when you got there, and you were sort of observing it as an outsider. And it made me wonder when I read this, if people assumed when you wrote in Brixton, when you wrote in Brixton Rock and submitted this, that people just assumed in a way that that was less hard work for you, that it was actually your patois and that you were just sort of plonking down on paper what you already knew. Was that a feeling that you felt and experienced?
Yes, it was a feeling I had, because that inventiveness of the way people interact with each other, you know, especially the young people of Brixton, was something I didn't grow up with. It didn't come naturally to me. Mind you, though, because I had to observe so many conversations and listen and pay attention, I guess I picked it up that bit quicker. Mm-hmm. I had to interact with these people, you know, these young people, to be part of, I guess, when you're that age, no one wants to be an outsider. You want to belong to something. You want to mix in with everybody and don't stick out. So I was no different. So I was like a sponge, just absorbing it all. So, yes, I think at times in my career, it's been quite unfair that people just expect me to come up with this bouncy dialogue, because it's never came natural to me. Even in my Cronkton books, you know, I work very, very hard on the dialogue. Even in Kane Warriors, which is set in Jamaica, 1760, I always pay much more, some might say much more attention to the dialogue than the prose. I mean, it's where my skill set is, so I don't mind working hard at it, because every writer knows their strengths and their weaknesses. And my definite strength is my first-person narrative and my dialogue. So I work extra hard on that. I don't relax. I don't I don't take it for granted that it's always going to come. And so I'm always listening to different people speak all over the country. So, for instance, I might be in Edinburgh. I might hear a cool phrase, and that might make it into my Cronkton series one day. Or I could be in Devon or Cornwall, or I could be listening to a hip-hop track out of New York, you know. So I'm a sponge for anything that sounds really cool, really trendy, and so on. So I just put it in my what I call a literary melting pot. I mix it up, brew it up, and it comes out on the page.
Yeah, and it really comes across. I think, I mean, definitely as a reader, that does feel like your strength. It's such a joy to read. Cronkton, which you've just mentioned, Cronkton Knight, is one of your children's or young adults books, I should say, and won the 50th Guardian Children's Fiction Prize in 2016. You actually already had an MBE, but I think in which you got in 2008, but a wee while ago you switched from adult literature to children's literature and YA. Why the switch?
I was getting invited to so many more schools than I was to literary festivals around the country. And so it seemed like a natural step to write for that audience, because schools, especially in London, Manchester, Birmingham, they wanted me to visit their schools, talk about my journey, and talk about East of Acre Lane, Brixton Rock, because the characters are, what, 17, 18? And so at least year 10s and year 11s could relate to those characters. Or even times year 9s and year 8. And so for me, it was a natural progression. You know, have characters who are 14, 15, rather than 17, 18. It wasn't too much of a breakaway for me. And I absolutely enjoy it, because I remember going back to that age when I was, and it was so awkward, sometimes so funny, so embarrassing. All of us can remember those awkward moments when we were that age. And I think it's fun to go back and reflect, because sometimes as adults, we forget how intense those feelings were of embarrassment, or maybe fancying somebody from across your desk to another, you know, and those moments where you feel like the world is going against you, and those moments of being a rebel and, you know, you're rebelling from your parents and all things like that. And I enjoy that. I actually really enjoy the writing process when I'm describing those characters and those situations.
Do you feel like publishing in general has changed at all since the mid to late 90s, when you were trying to get Brixton Rock published and receiving rejections like the ones you said, which said, you know, there's no readership for black writing. I don't think anybody would write that down now. But does it feel like a different place?
Yes, it does. In terms of if I can speak about my second novel, East of Acre Lane, was published by HarperCollins. Now, I had an editor there, Leo Hollis, a great champion of my writing, and he really wanted to see my career grow. And so basically, Leo, at the acquisition meeting, say, look, I just want to publish Alex Wheatle. I think he's a great writer. And so he was allowed to do that. Today, say 20 years on from that, sometimes editors, they might have this great novel that they want to publish, but they might be denied by people in sales or international sales or marketing. And I think that's not good for our industry, because sometimes they go on by what has sold earlier or what has made money for them beforehand, rather than looking at the quality of the work that lays in front of them. So I think that industry has changed in that aspect, definitely so. Because I know many editors sometimes leave acquisition meetings in tears because they cannot greenlight the books they really want to work on. Especially in the larger publishing houses. It's no coincidence that many of the smaller publishers, they're getting so many awards for their for what they publish on their list. Because sometimes the big companies are too kind of risk averse, and they don't green light projects that they should do because of the quality of the work. It's sometimes, as I said before, you've got these middle people who kind of block a fantastic project or idea. So it's changing that way. That's a black writing. Obviously, over the years, we've managed to see published all a diversity of writers, not just in colour, but on the themes that we are presenting to the publishers now. I mean, you could read books about the black experience in all shapes and form, which I think is a fantastic thing. My only regret is that not too many black male writers in the UK are being published at the moment. So, you know, I'm always looking for new arrivals in that field, but there's not too many at the moment. So we need work on that. Maybe the skill set is for writing is going into grime or other art forms. Who knows? But speaking to my agent, she says she very rarely receives manuscripts from young black men who live in the UK.
That's interesting. Do you think that not necessarily even black men, but perhaps young men in general think of it as perhaps, I don't know, a feminine pursuit or just creativity in that way might be seen as not very manly?
Could well be. I remember, Francesca, that when I mentioned to friends that I'm writing a novel, they would smirk and giggle and what's Alex doing? Is he becoming a girl? You know, that was in the mid-90s. Maybe that still exists in some way or form. But I know there's the creative energy. I've been to secondary schools in London, in Manchester and so on. I know there's a buzz about creativity in a written form. It's where that written form takes those artists, of what field they want to operate in is the important question. Do they want to write novels? Do they want to be grime artists? Do they want to be poets? I mean, at Joe Biden's inauguration, we had, I cannot remember her name now, we had that superstar, what's her name?
Yes, Amanda.
Amanda Gorman, was it?
Yeah.
Amanda Gorman, and she wowed the world, didn't she? And
yeah, so it was amazing.
That is all fantastic and brilliant, but are we going to lose all their young talent trying to emulate her rather than writing fiction and novels?
That's such an interesting question. Yes, and then there's sort of one ceiling breaker and then no one else is allowed to get through the gap.
Yes, there's that issue too. So, you know, writing a novel is not easy. You probably know this, Francesca. It's not easy. You've got to dedicate yourself to it. You've got to live with those characters in your head for a long while. Or sometimes if you're living with a partner, they think, where's your mind at, kind of thing, you know. but it's a long process, isn't it?
And how long does it take you on average?
It's a long commitment.
How long does it take you on average to write a book, and how and where do you do it?
Normally at home. If it's a nice spring day or summer's day, I might take my laptop to the bandstand at Clapham Common and spend a few hours there. For the Crompton series, in general, ran about 8 to 9 months, I finished your first draft. And then, of course, there's the editing process that I work with my agent and then my editor at the publishing house. So normally round about a year or so. For a novel like Island Songs, which is set in Jamaica, obviously I'd have to do a lot more research. And that particular book took me about 3 to 4 months researching, about a year, 3 months to write, and then another 3 months or so of editing. So almost 2 years.
It's quite quick, really, and you're pretty prolific. I mean, I think have you written 17 books? Is that right?
Something like that, yeah.
I think the moment you say something like that, you've written a lot.
So I
noticed you did change publisher from between your first and second book. You picked up by a much larger publisher. How did that happen? What was that like?
Well, I felt really bad, to be honest. I mean, obviously Rosemary found me, but obviously she's a small press, and you know, I want to make a living out of this if I can. And so HarperCollins came along, they offered me a contract, and I signed, and I still feel bad about it to this day. But, you know, creatives, you know, even though it's fun getting published and fun to see your books on bookshelves in all the towns in the UK and beyond, you want to make a living as well.
Sure.
So I decided to give up work. I was working as an engineer. We used to make components for aircraft in a factory in Northwest London. And I thought, you know what, I really want to commit to my craft. And so I decided to sign with HarperCollins, give up work and concentrate on writing full time.
And was that on the basis of Brixton Rock having done so well that HarperCollins approached you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because that was very well reviewed. People were talking about it. I was interviewed a lot on radio and so forth. So that opened a door for me.
What was it like having had, you mentioned before, writing being your therapy, helping get rid of that self-doubt you had had, lack of confidence you'd had as a child growing up? And then suddenly you're not just writing alone and using that as your therapy, but having to talk to people on the radio about it and talk to me now. What was that like? Because that's quite a different skill set and a very different type of exposure.
I had to learn that, Francesca. It took me quite a while. I remember I was asked to go on Newsnight. I think it was Jeremy Vine asking the questions. I cannot remember what the subject matter was. And I remember freezing. I had this brain freeze moment, you know, where nothing would come out of my mouth. And so it took me quite a while to adjust to that new kind of experience of being on live TV, being in a BBC radio studio with a big fat microphone on the middle of the table where you're aware of all the hundreds of thousands listening to this particular episode. So it took me a while. Hopefully I'm a bit more confident and easy now, but at the time, sometimes I found it terrifying.
You seem like a natural at it now, but I guess you've had 20 years of practice. What have you, if anything, is there anything you have learned from the rejections that you received over Brixton Rock? Because, it was quite a lengthy period and you'd already had, you know, a lifetime of rejection before that, really, in a personal sense. So was there anything that you learned from publishing rejection or writing rejection?
To believe in my own talent, I guess. And I have to thank Simeon for that, my cellmate. He instilled that in me. I remember him reading it and he said, "Alex, this is good stuff." Those were his words. "This is good stuff. This is a story that needs to be read and needs to be told. So stick with it, my brother." That's what he would say. And so I guess his issues were that improve your grammar, make sure it's readable, you know, all those kind of advices that he used to give me. So I believed in him. And so that made me believe in myself.
And get a typewriter or a computer.
Get a typewriter, yeah. Just going back to my first computer, it's one of those Amstrad things. You're probably too young to remember this, Francesca.
Yeah, I do vaguely remember Amstrad.
they had this dot matrix printer, and I used to print my work at night, and it used to infuriate the whole family.
You mentioned your family during the process of, you said you celebrated with them when you heard that Brixton Rock was being published. Did you mean your wife and children in that celebration? Is that who you mean by your family? So when you were writing and when you were attempting to get Brixton Rock published, I mean, I have two small children, so I know it can affect the way you approach writing or anything. Did that impact your need for publishing success or how you dealt with anything?
I guess my main motivation was that I wanted them to be proud of me, proud of their dad, you know, my kids, and my wife proud of me too, because she's seen the you know, me not in the best light sometimes. She's seen me struggle with my mental health. She's seen me struggle with life, accepting, you know, going through that process of facing up to that trauma from my past. She's seen all that. So to actually celebrate with them, hey, you know, despite everything, I have this book. Isn't it a beautiful thing? And so I think we went out somewhere just to enjoy that moment. I think we had dinner somewhere. I cannot remember where. And, you know, my book was on the table alongside me and my kids were looking at it. And even though they still see me as dad, it was a special moment.
Yeah.
Again, it gave me that sense of confidence, if you like, that I can achieve despite what has gone on beforehand.
Yes, I suppose in a way, I mean, I was going to ask, you know, what was the moment when you felt successful, but maybe it's just a really incremental process by bits.
Yeah, I think so. But nothing's beyond us, really. You know, it's so nice that sometimes I'm nominated for this award and that award. But really, the biggest thrill, the biggest sense of achievement I had was when that first book was published. Mm. You know, I cannot get away from that moment. I can remember it vividly, seeing my book in the Borders store, the whole wall, because I had an event there soon after publication. I think it was March 1999. And I'm backdropped by something like 50 books of Bricks and Rock. that was such a proud moment. You know, and then people starting to sit down in front of me, waiting for me to address them and perform a reading. And I was so, so nervous, but so, so proud.
Do you think that the industry or readers can do anything to improve things for writers of colour? I know you've talked about school curriculums changing and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. Our books could be included in the school curriculum more, especially in a historical aspect. But also, we don't just need writers, Francesca. We need more editors. We need more agents. We need more marketing people. We need more salespeople. You know, we need to fill all those positions. You know, so that is what is lacking at the moment. And I think until we do, you know, we might struggle to get our stories acquired or acquisitioned. But hopefully we can encourage our young to go into the publishing profession, because it's very expensive, because it's very London-centric. And even though this pandemic has been absolutely appalling, I believe it offers us the opportunity in the publishing world to reshape our model of business. So many people in our business have been working from home for over a year. Do we really need those big spaces? So hopefully this will open up potential possibilities of people in the regions, living in the regions, you know, Durham, Newcastle, Manchester, wherever. Maybe these big publishers can open up small offices in the regions of the UK so we can attract all the talent, where you don't have to pay extortionate rents to live in London to join the publishing world. Mm. I really hope that we get to see that very soon.
In Bricks and Rock, Brenton, who, as we've said, is a sort of fictionalised version of you, I think, is that a fair way to describe him, by the way?
Yeah,
I'm always conscious
more or less,
that, you know, he tells his social worker, and I quote, "You can read all the books you want, but that won't make a difference because you don't actually know what it feels like to live my shit of a life." Do you think that that's true,
that's
or can
me.
Books transcend that a little bit?
That is me. That's probably how I felt at 16, 17, 18, 20 years old. But I think books can transcend that, and books can lead to empathy. I really strongly believe that. I think the more you read, the more empathy you inbuild in yourself. And so there's no doubt that I think that if that social worker who I described in that scene actually read books by the likes of Brenton Brown or whoever, and so they could feel their pain, their life journey, and they could feel their lived experience, I think we all become much better people, don't we?
Mm. Do you ever dwell on what a hard, you know, difficult hand you were dealt in early life? Does it make you angry, or does it still occur to you?
Yes, I'm human, Francesca. So there are times that I wake up, you know, where I let the rage out. I might scream in the early hours in the middle of Clapham Common, something I've done before, I'll have to admit. Yes, of course, I get angry. But also, Also, Francesca, I've travelled quite widely. You know, writing has given me that opportunity. And so I've been to the ghettos of Kingston, Jamaica. I've seen children with absolutely nothing. And that humbles you. You know, I've seen real hardship, real hunger in places. I've been to South Africa where I went to a township there in a festival. I went to a festival a few years ago and I was taken out to one of these townships. And, you know, in these communities, sometimes the electricity goes out for 3-4 days. Mm. You know, and they don't have the books and texts that we do in the UK. You know, if you want to have a book, you know, you've got to treasure it. You got to, you know, and once you read it, you got to pass it on to somebody else so they can enjoy. Mm. You know, I don't like to look at myself as a victim. Mm. I like to look at myself as a survivor. Mm. You know, yes, it's very unfortunate start for me, but I have to make the best of what I have, because it's, even though it's unfortunate, it's a much better start than a lot of kids in this world that I've seen, that I've seen up close. So that gives me energy, that gives me motivation to continue. Yeah, we have to, you know, be balanced, I think, and appreciate what we do have. Yes, I'm the first one to have a go at governments who might fail us or might fail poor working class people. Oh, I'm going to be first in the queue for that. But also, I do appreciate that in the UK is where I made my name, is where I read my books in my formative years, is where I established myself. So I'm very proud of that. But I'm always going to have an eye on those who suffer in this world, because I have that inbuilt empathy because of what I went through. And I always try to serve that in my writing.
Thank you so much for listening to Write Off. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you do have a chance to leave a review or rating, I'd really appreciate it. You can do that in your podcast app, and it really helps people find the podcast. Plus, it just makes me feel good, to be honest. Guests still to come on the podcast include Michelle Roberts and Douglas Stewart. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm at Francesca Steele with an E at the end. So do pop along and say hello. Hope to see you there. Bye.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets, featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.